35 years after its launch, Voyager 1 is now the most distant man-made object, more than 11 billion miles from the sun. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Voyager 1 was launched way back in 1977. And as Voyager 1 marks its 35th birthday, and as the spacecraft nears interstellar space, we'll talk with Voyager 1 scientist and University of Iowa space physicist Don Gurnett. He'll tell us what Voyager 1 has revealed to us over its lifetime and about the next phase of the spacecraft's journey. All about Voyager 1 and the final frontier after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Remember 1977? Jimmy Carter was president. The miniseries on television Roots became the most highly rated show ever broadcast. And at the box office, Close Encounters of the Third Kind and, of course, Star Wars were the biggest hits. And suitably so, since 1977 was also the year that NASA launched Voyager 1 and 2. Voyager 1 blasted off in early September of that year. And during its journey, it's completed flybys of both Jupiter and Saturn. And now, on the spacecraft's 35th anniversary, it's on the verge of leaving our solar system. Voyager 1 is now more than 11 billion miles away from Earth. It is the most distant man-made object. And remember this aspect of the project? Voyager 1 carries with it a golden record filled with images, music, and sounds of our planet. Greetings like these.
Hello from the children of planet Earth.
Bonjour tout le monde.
Hola y saludos a todos.
Herzliche Grüße an alle.
Konnichiwa, o genki desu ka?
And sounds like these from Earth.
Oh, come on now.
I think you recognized all of those. Also, music like this.
Go, Johnny, go, go. Go, Johnny, go, go. Johnny, be good.
Don't worry, classical music fans. There's also plenty of that on the golden record. These sounds and greetings, images, all there in case that craft would ever encounter intelligent life as it moves outward toward the stars. Voyager project scientist and Burlington, Iowa native Ed Stone reminds us of what Voyager's mission was when it set out 35 years ago.
The two Voyagers were designed for what was called the Grand Tour, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Every 176 years, those four planets are lined up so a single spacecraft can fly by all four. And the launch year was 1977, plus or minus a year, in order to accomplish that. So the two Voyagers were intended for that mission, although initially mission success was just a four-year mission to Saturn. Everything else was added one piece at a time because it was unclear how long these spacecraft could last. Remember, when the two Voyagers were launched in 1977, the space age itself was only 20 years old, so there was very little experience about these very long-duration missions. I began as project scientist in 1972 when the mission actually got its start, and we knew it was going to be a mission to discovery because these were going to be the first flybys with advanced instrumentation among these giant planets, which have miniature solar systems around them with lots of moons. And it was even more discovery than any of us expected because we found everything was distinct. There were no replicas one after the other. We saw one moon after the other different, one magnetic field after the other was different, one ring system after the other was different. It's all different. And, of course, that's where you have a lot of opportunity to learn.
Ed Stone, Voyager project scientist, Burlington, Iowa native, telling us of what Voyager's mission was when it set out 35 years ago in 1977. Now Voyager is on the cusp of another discovery as it prepares to cross outside of our solar system. Joining me now and staying with us for the entire hour, Voyager 1 scientist and University of Iowa space physicist, Also a native of Iowa, native of Fairfax, Don Gurnett is with us. He's the principal investigator for Voyager 1's Plasma Wave Unit. We'll find out about that. He's worked on that mission since the mid-1970s. Don Gurnett, it's such a pleasure to have you in our studio today. Thank you for coming in.
Well, good morning. Pleased to be here.
You predicted, let's talk about what's happening right now with this spacecraft that incredibly, at least for me, finding out more, it's still sending us signals after all this time. In 1993, you predicted that the spacecraft would encounter what is called the heliopause. And so in recent weeks, I understand, it's been sending back some signs that it may be getting close to the edge of our solar system. Explain what this is, the heliopause, and what you're awaiting right now.
Okay. Well, the heliopause is a boundary between the what we call the solar wind, which is a gas streaming out in all directions from the sun. And eventually this boundary is there's a boundary formed out there between the solar wind and what we call the interstellar medium, the gas between the stars. And we know very little about the interstellar medium. And, well, at one time we thought it was relatively close to the sun, maybe just a bit beyond the orbit of Jupiter. But in 1993, I made a measurement, actually, with Voyager, where we predicted the distance was out somewhere beyond 116 astronomical units. An astronomical unit is the distance between the sun and the Earth. Voyager is now beyond that boundary, and there's good evidence that we're now finally approaching this boundary. Mm-hmm. I might comment on the almost stupendous distance that we've reached from the sun.
More than 11 billion miles. Can you make that comprehensible to us?
Yeah, I'll try to give you a feeling for that. We like to measure things in astronomical units. That we're at 121 astronomical units. That's compared to the distance from Earth to the sun. But put it in more practical terms, that's about three times as far out as Pluto. And another way to kind of grasp how far from the Earth we are, it now takes almost 17 hours for the radio signal to get back to the Earth. 17 hours. You got to let that sink in, because radio waves propagate at the speed of light. That's 186,000 miles per second. You may remember, perhaps you do, when the astronauts landed on the moon, when mission control would ask them a question, there was a discernible delay in their response, about a second or so, maybe 2 seconds. Mm-hmm. And so it takes a little over a second for a radio wave to go to the moon. And we're out there at almost 17 hours now.
The distances are unfathomable, really. And also, when we hear, at least in Hollywood often, the distances in space being described as light years, astronomical units are a small portion of a light year. So we're not even talking about, are we talking about any small fraction of a light year here?
Oh, no. Astronomers like to talk about distance in light years, the distance that light will travel in 1 year. Now, at 17, we're not anywhere near a light year, but at 17 hours, we're getting to be a good fraction of a light day. Distances in space are really difficult to fathom. You might, for example, ask the question of how long it's going to be till we get to a nearest star. We're moving out at the highest velocity of any object ever made by human. We use gravity-assisted Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune to increase the speed of the spacecraft. How long do you think it'll take till we get to the nearest star, which is about 4 light years?
Oh, hundreds of thousands of years?
Well, you're in the right ballpark. It's about 30,000 years.
Okay.
So, you know, that's the fastest object we can make with a human right now.
So if we want to get out there in any reasonable time, we've got to get a different propulsion.
We have to have significant improvements in rocket propulsion, big improvements, factor of 10,000.
Voyager 1 scientist, University of Iowa space physicist with us this hour, Don Gurnett. If you'd like to join our conversation, your questions about the Voyager project, about its journey, its exploration of space, all welcome this hour. We'd love to hear from you. 1-866-780-9100 is our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100. river2river@iowapublicradio.org, our email. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Talk a little bit about, we just mentioned propulsion, about how a craft like this, and if you see pictures of it, it doesn't look at all aerodynamic as you would here in Earth. Where does it get its power to go such a great distance?
Well, it gets its power from the initial launch at Cape Kennedy, which, of course, is a rocket. We used the biggest rocket we had available at that time, which was a Titan 3C with a Centaur upper stage. The upper stage is a very high-performance vehicle that burned liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. And that got us to Jupiter in about a year and a half, which is a pretty short flight time to get to Jupiter. But then we used what we call gravity assist. We flew by, you know, Jupiter's going around the sun at a pretty good clip, and so we flew in a certain sense behind Jupiter, and Jupiter's immense gravity pulls on the spacecraft and kind of slingshots it, and you get almost double the velocity at Jupiter. Then we did that again at Saturn and got another boost, and that has us going out from the sun on an escape velocity of about 3.5 AU per year, mm-hmm. which cannot be achieved directly. For example, with Voyager 2, we flew to Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, sometimes called the Grand Tour. These planets were lined up in just the right place that we could carry out a flight like that. You know, these planets go around the sun at different rates, and it's only once every 180 years that they get into the proper configuration to do that.
And so that's why also another Voyager 2 was launched. Actually, Voyager 2, I understand, launched before Voyager 1.
That's correct. Voyager 2 was on a slower trajectory. It launched a little bit earlier in the launch window. And so we flipped the names. We have the names in the order that they reached Jupiter. Voyager 1 did not go to Uranus and Neptune, and that's because at Saturn, Carl Sagan wanted us to fly by and explore a giant moon called Titan, which we did, a very fascinating moon. Once we did that, we couldn't go to Uranus and Neptune, so that was our final planet.
So that leads to a question that I had about this is – when it was launched in 1977, it's not as if it was launched and its plan was all made. You can, as scientists, in an impromptu fashion, make some adjustments to its flight plan.
Yes, that's correct. I might say not much, but there is propulsion on board, just for mid-course corrections, small corrections. But a great deal of planning went into before launch and exactly the right trajectory, so when we get to Jupiter, we could fly by several of the moons of Jupiter and things like that. We can make course corrections, small course corrections.
Can you tell us, back to where Voyager 1 is right now, on the outskirts of our solar system, could it be actually outside our solar system now? Is that a clear line or is it a blur?
Well, that is a bit of an issue, what it means to be outside of our solar system. The way we're talking about it, there's this gaseous envelope around the sun that I termed the solar wind. It's blowing out from the sun all the time. And someday that has to be stopped by the interstellar gas. That's the boundary I'm talking about. Now, some other people think of the boundary of the solar system as how far out does the gravity of the sun reach, and that is considerably farther. There's objects out there called Kuiper Belt objects, kind of like Pluto, actually, that are still beyond us, and we will not be able to fly by any of those. That's the reason, by the way, that Pluto was demoted from a planet. There were getting to be too many other objects out there we discovered that were kind of like Pluto.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wanted to play another cut from your colleague, Ed Stone. You've worked with him for decades.
I have.
On this project. Also an Iowa native, a former director of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, a project scientist for the Voyager spacecraft missions. He was back in his hometown. Yours is Fairfax.
Fairfax, right.
He calls Burlington his hometown. He was back there recently and spoke with Iowa Public Radio's John Pemble. And in this cut, he recounts the many discoveries of Voyager over its 35-year history.
Before Voyager, the only known active volcanoes in the solar system were here on Earth. And then we flew by Io, and here's a little tiny moon with 10 times the volcanic activity of Earth. That's the kind of expansion of our perceptions that occurred with Voyager. Before Voyager, the only liquid water ocean known in the solar system was here on Earth. Now we think there's a liquid water ocean on Europa. We think there's liquid water underneath the surface of Enceladus. There's even a suggestion maybe there's liquid water buried deep underneath the ice on Titan, of all things. So, again, I think we have learned that we do need to be broader in terms of what's possible than we might have been before Voyager. I think that's one of the big lessons from Voyager is nature seems to be much more expansive in its solutions than we had been in our own minds.
Voyager Project scientist Ed Stone there, Don Gurnett with us live. For you, Don Gurnett, as a scientist working on this project for more than three decades, what are the big lessons for you, or are they the same?
Oh, I'll have to tell you, Voyager was just a tremendous mission. I mean, I just feel privileged to have been involved in it. What you have to think about is that, for example, there are these four large satellites at Jupiter called the Galilean satellites. He discovered those satellites in the famous year 1610. And ever since then, even with our best telescopes at Earth, all you could say is they were just dots of light. I mean, you really can't resolve them. And in March of 1979, I remember all this vividly. We flew by Jupiter, went by some of these moons, and just, you know, overnight, in a matter of hours, we close in on a moon like Io, and you get these pictures, just tremendous pictures. Io looked like a pizza. In fact, it was joked at the time that we had the pizza model of Io. And so, you know, over 400 years since Galileo, we knew nothing almost about these moons. And now we know that Io, for example, is the most the black dots on it, those are volcanoes. It's the most volcanic object in the solar system. Another huge moon called Ganymede that is a huge, essentially a ball of water ice, almost as big as the planet Mercury. And then we go out to Saturn, and we fly by Saturn, and we go by this moon, Titan, which is the one that Carl Sagan wanted to visit. And the reason we wanted to go there was that Titan, we knew, had an atmosphere. They could detect methane. But then again, in just a matter of a few hours, we close in and fly by Titan. And just an incredible place, actually. Mm-hmm. It has a nitrogen atmosphere. It's the only object in the solar system other than Earth that has a dense nitrogen atmosphere. It has an atmosphere of pressure 1.5 times the Earth's atmosphere. But more startling than that, they discovered that the atmosphere is just full of hydrocarbons. It's very cold. It's almost minus 400 Fahrenheit. And you could see these layers in the atmosphere, kind of haze layers, that were different hydrocarbons. Like,
what is the significance of hydrocarbons?
Why? Ultimately, origin of life. It means that these hydrocarbons were there probably in the formation of the solar system. You can see ethane, propane, acetylene, hydrogen cyanide, just a whole spectrum of these things. And now we have another spacecraft that's called Cassini, which is in orbit around Saturn, and we're making close flybys with a radar of this moon, and we can see lakes on the surface of the moon. And in fact, you could see river tributaries. And, you know, at that temperature, the surface is mostly water ice, but you can't have liquid water at that temperature. And it was finally realized that the cloud system you see at Titan is actually methane, natural gas. And at that cold temperature, the methane forms methane droplets, and it's raining hydrocarbons at Titan. I mean, this is like the stuff of science fiction. Mm. In fact, I've been asked to give talks at science fiction conferences because some of the things we see out there are so bizarre. Anyway, I participated in all these kind of discoveries, and I teach astronomy. It is the Voyager mission wrote a good part of the astronomy book about anything to do with the outer planets. You pick up an astronomy book now, and you'll still find all these tremendous number of pictures of all these moons and places out there. Yeah, you might call me an enthusiast, Okay. A Voyager.
Don Gurnett, we'll add that to your titles. Enthusiast, Voyager 1 scientist, University of Iowa space scientist, has been working in this area for over a half century, has been working with the Voyager project for over 35 years, since the mid-1970s. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Give us a tweet if you'd like at IPR Talk. Here's a question in our email basket. Tim in Adel asks, I seem to remember that Voyager's main radio failed, and it has been working on a backup radio ever since, and this radio has the power of a dim torch battery. Is this true? How do you track such a weak signal over 11 billion miles? How long does it take the signal to get back there? You answered that. That was
About 17 hours.
17 hours. But, okay, is it true that the main radio failed?
Well, let me comment. The transmitter on both spacecraft radiates 23 watts of power. And the signal when we're out there this far is so weak that we use the biggest antenna that we have in the deep space network. It's a 210-foot diameter antenna. And we have to point the spacecraft also has a, we call it a high-gain antenna, about 10-foot diameter dish, and it has to always be pointed exactly back at the Earth, otherwise we wouldn't get the signal. Mm-hmm. But we have to array that big 210-foot antenna now with another antenna. By array, I mean you have to combine the signals with a 34-foot antenna. Now, let me comment about you called it failure in the transmitter. Actually, there wasn't really a failure. There were some fluctuations in the power level, and we got a bit nervous about that. And we were afraid it would suddenly quit one day, and then we wouldn't be able to communicate. Well, we could send commands to it, but we didn't want that to happen. So there was a spare transmitter on board that had never been used. It was only last time it was used prior to launch. And we switched the transmitter, and the unused transmitter just came right on at the proper power and everything. That was a bit of a nervous thing, actually, I have to say.
Are you surprised that Voyager 1 has survived this long, 35 years? Was it planned to be so?
Well, the original plan, kind of a long story about that, I'll try to make it short here. The original plan was called Grand Tour, to go to Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. But Congress didn't fund it, so we changed the name and reduced the cost, and it was at that time called the Mariner Jupiter Saturn mission, just went to Saturn. But, of course, after we launched it, the two spacecraft planets were in the same place, and we got to Saturn, and it was changed to the Uranus-Neptune mission. We got to Neptune, and it was changed to the Voyager Interstellar mission. So there's a long time, there's a long story behind this.
A lot of politics connected with space exploration, as we're hearing. We have to take a short break, and then we'll be back with more in our discussion with Don Gurnett, University of Iowa space physicist, Voyager 1 scientist, has been working with the Voyager project for over 35 years. Join our conversation with your questions, your comments about the exploration of space, about this specific project, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, or tweet us at IPR Talk. When we come back, we'll talk about the space program now as it is compared to the 1970s, yet those things are certainly political forces at work, shall we say, on the space exploration in this country. When we come back, this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're celebrating a birthday on River to River today, the birthday of Voyager 1. That spacecraft blasted off in early September of 1977. And during its journey, it's done many amazing things. It's still sending signals back now. It completed a flyby of Jupiter, Saturn, now on its 35th anniversary. It's on the verge of leaving our solar system, now more than 11 billion miles from the Earth. It is the most distant man-made object. And here to discuss that with us this hour, Voyager 1 scientist, University of Iowa space scientist, Don Gurnett. And we're also having his colleagues in a recorded interview, some clips from him, Ed Stone, recorded by John Pemble earlier this year, both Iowa natives. I wanted, before the break, I said we were going to talk about comparing this, the space program now with then in the mid-70s, but you go back even further than the mid-70s to the late 50s with your involvement in the space program. Can you tell us how it all started?
Yeah, I can comment on that, actually. I guess in high school, I was kind of a space enthusiast, but that's before the space program. I remember I had a book, the little book on space travel, which I think I received at my 12th birthday. And I used to build model airplanes, radio control with tubes. You ever remember what tubes are?
Sure, sure.
And that's actually what got me into electronics. And I also built rockets in high school using saltpeter, charcoal, and sulfur. I remember there was a druggist up in Cedar Rapids. I remember he asked me one day, son, what are you doing with this stuff? And I said, I'm making rockets. And he said, well, have fun. But anyway, I arrived here on about September 20th, 1957, which was kind of a famous year because I was only here a couple of weeks and Sputnik 1 was launched. And that had a tremendous impact on the United States. I remember going out and watching it go over and so forth.
You could actually see it, and then all of a sudden Washington had plenty of money for the University of Iowa, where you just arrived.
That eventually is true. It made the United States look like where they were behind in engineering and rocket development and all that sort of thing. And anyway, just a few months after that, Explorer 1 was launched with Jim Van Allen's Geiger tube on it. And I was studying in the engineering building, and Van Allen was in the physics building just across the street. So I went over and asked him if I could, if there was possibly a job. And he sent me a note about a month after that and invited me to work with him. So I got involved in designing spacecraft electronics almost right from the beginning. So I had a very good view of this whole history of this thing. Of course, in the early days, about half of the rockets would fail. In fact, the very first project I went on, I worked on the rocket, went in the ocean. Mm-hmm. And then in those days, you know, we built the first spacecraft ever built at a university here. That was in 1960, and I designed the data system on that, a digital data system. And one of the things that I ended up doing, I was project engineer on, there was a series called the Engine Spacecraft built here at the University of Iowa. And there was a guy here gave a talk where he played some sounds that were radio sounds called whistlers. And I'm going to play some whistlers for you.
You have your laptop with you today, brought in some sounds. Whistlers are found on Earth, but also other planets.
Right.
Tell us what they are.
That's correct. So I built a receiver, and I asked Jim Van Allen if I could put it on the spacecraft. And he said, sure. You got to compare that now when you send in a proposal to NASA. It might take 2 years to get evaluated, and you might or might not get selected. But anyway, we launched the spacecraft. It was Engine 3, and we transmitted the signal back to the ground, and it was pretty spectacular. Whistlers are produced by lightning, and what happens, the high frequencies travel faster than the low frequencies, and you hear a whistling signal that goes like that. And I'll play some of the recordings, actually, from Engine 3 back in, I think it was 1961, right after it was launched. So here I'll play them. Each of these whistling sounds is produced by, we're flying over a thunderstorm. So here we go. And I eventually wrote my PhD thesis on some phenomena associated with these whistling sounds. There are some other things I could play here, but probably don't have enough time. We also made the first space measurements of another phenomena, which was called dawn chorus. The reason it's called dawn chorus, it sounds in England, that name, dawn chorus, refers to the birds when they wake up in the morning and they start singing. And we showed that this phenomena is produced by the Van Allen radiation belts, and I'll play it here, and it's kind of a bit of a musical sound, sort of. You'll hear it here.
Oh, Wow.
And it's a pretty amazing thing, really. The electrons in the radiation belt get together and they just emit these whistling sounds all by themselves.
Sounds like you could be in a jungle somewhere.
It sounds like you'd be in a jungle. Actually, it's a serious subject because these waves scatter the radiation belt particles and cause them to be lost from the system. So they're quite important. In fact, if any of your listeners want to come and sign up for a plasma physics, which I'm teaching this year, we'll explain how that's produced.
Well, also, you mentioned in the break, and we want to give our listeners that information because you delivered a lecture on this, which you incorporated sounds and so forth, and that can be found on the Internet where?
Well, you can go to my website in the physics department at the University of Iowa, Don Gurnett. Get to my website, and then you can find the presidential lecture. That was the University of Iowa presidential lecture they gave one. I gave that, and you can listen to the entire lecture by just clicking on it.
Okay, and we've also put it on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page.
Okay.
To find that link, simply go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. 1-866-780-9100 if you'd like to join our conversation with Iowa University of Iowa space physicist Don Gurnett. Tell us, when you compare the impetus you had after Sputnik in the late 50s into the 60s and 70s and the manned moon missions with the space program today, how is that character different? Is there as much support? Is it just different in character, or is there just generally less support?
Well, let me distinguish between robotic spacecraft and human spacecraft, often called manned spaceflight. Most of our work here has been in the robotic arena, and that has changed tremendously in some respects. The main thing is that in the early days, we would build a spacecraft in less than a year. I actually participated in that. Whereas nowadays, some of these space missions take several years to plan, five or more years to build. Like flying to the outer planets, Cassini took 7 years from the launch to get there, to get to Saturn. It's now in orbit around Saturn. So a lot of the timescales have, and they've gotten more expensive. You know, that's kind of the way research is. You do the easy stuff first, then it gets harder and harder. But I am still so very impressed with, especially the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which I work with so closely. For example, recently they landed that rover on Mars. I know the guys that did that. In fact, the project manager once worked on one of our projects, not at the University of Iowa. He was an experiment rep out at JPL. He was just a young kid. Now he's managing a project, and that was a very complicated thing to land on Mars. So, and it's it's expensive. Those are kind of billion-dollar missions, but I think they're worthy of support. Now, the human spaceflight program, I think, has gotten into some kind of deep trouble here because, of course, the shuttle's no longer flying, and it's kind of the result of, I think, not adequate planning years ago on what to do with the humans in space.
Well, I know. I think James Van Allen was against putting humans in space. He said you get much more bang for your buck, so to speak, when you don't put humans in space, because you have to have all these systems to keep a biological form alive. Now, what is your view on that?
Well, Jim Van Allen was a persistent critic for exactly those reasons. It's very expensive. Now, I personally regard landing a human on the moon, like Neil Armstrong, who just died recently, as a milestone in human achievement, having a human walk on the moon. But the problem as I see it now is there are really only three places you can send humans. One is to the moon, second to an asteroid, or third is Mars. You can't consider sending a human to Venus. The surface temperature is 900 degrees Fahrenheit. Interesting story right there, because it's the carbon dioxide atmosphere and the high temperature is caused by the greenhouse effect. But we'll skip that lecture. And there's really Jupiter has such an intense radiation belt, it's just impossible. You can hardly make a spacecraft survive there. So, okay. The moon, we've been there, done that. You can give reasons to go back, but I personally think it's hard to justify.
Mm-hmm.
An asteroid, they're small objects, a few miles in diameter. And, of course, one of the pieces of significance or item of significance with respect to an asteroid is asteroid is believed to have wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. So from a human population point of view, you really ought to pay attention to asteroids. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure that going landing on one of them is the way to do that. We have a program to track them now and try to identify Earth-crossing asteroids and so forth.
We want to mention, too, that you're the principal investigator of an instrument aboard the Cassini space probe, which is now, you said, orbiting Saturn. And it's interesting also when we juxtapose our time with an earlier time, is that anybody can see images that Cassini has taken. We can see them on our smartphones, on our iPads, on our tablets, on our computers. How has that changed exploration? Because really, it's almost as if we are all on board if we want to be, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, that is a tremendous change. I might tell you, in the very early days that I talked about a while ago, we didn't even have computers. You had to plot things by hand. And now, you know, you can just press a button or go to the JPL, Jet Propulsion, or NASA website, type in Cassini, CASSINI, and you can look at pictures that were transmitted yesterday. So it is a very different in how quickly information or these images, great images and things of Saturn with all its rings, and it's really a tremendous, it's almost like you're being there. I think that's kind of an interesting contrast with human spaceflight, actually. When I see these things, like the discovery of Io at Jupiter, it's like I was there, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
And you don't have to risk the hazards of that to a spacecraft.
I don't, and I probably wouldn't.
Now, it's interesting. We've remarked that both you and Ed Stone are native Iowans. Two of the five Voyager scientists are from Iowa. That's remarkable. How did that happen?
Well, it's a little hard for me to say. I mean, you know my history. It was,
well, you explained it, yeah.
Just kind of an accident. I showed up at the University of Iowa right shortly before Sputnik 1 was launched, and Van Allen was here, and I started working for him. I don't actually know the entire history of how Ed ended up in the space program. I think you might have to – I know him very well, but I just can't relate exactly how he ended up at Caltech and head of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. A very accomplished person, huh?
Now, back to Voyager 1. It's on the edge of our solar system. You said you're very interested in the medium outside the solar system. That has not been explored by our instruments. So let's talk a little bit. What is next for Voyager? After it gets out of the solar system, what are the big questions that you and the other space scientists connected with this program have once it breaks through the heliopause?
Yes, the heliopause. I'll repeat again, the heliopause is the outer boundary of the solar wind, this gas flowing out from the sun. It's stopped by the interstellar medium. Now, this region inside the heliopause, we call it the heliosphere, has very turbulent magnetic fields, and it impedes the entry of cosmic rays into the solar system. In fact, our cosmic ray flux, which is penetrating your body all the time, is significantly reduced by the presence of the heliosphere. As soon as we get outside the heliosphere, we'll finally be exposed to the true cosmic ray flux of particles.
And up to this point, it's only been what, theory?
It's only been conjectured. We don't really know. In fact, very recently on Voyager, the cosmic ray instrument has started to see an increase in the cosmic ray intensity. That's what Ed Stone does. He's involved in the cosmic ray experiment. We also don't know the magnetic field in the interstellar medium, and as soon as we get across that boundary, we will for the first time be able to make measurements of the magnetic field. Now, I don't know whether that's of great significance or not. The magnetic field doesn't hurt humans, but I guess cosmic rays could, especially astronauts. But I find it of considerable interest to see in fact, I made a prediction of the magnetic field direction out there, which we will see.
Will that be within the next few months or years? Or?
Well, we don't know that. We are in some kind of a strange boundary layer, maybe. We don't really know. We just had a meeting on, talked about the results. We've seen a small effect in our instrument that may be suggesting we're going into a region of higher density. Actually, that's what we expect when we go from the solar wind. We expect the plasma density to increase a lot, like there's a wall there. maybe increasing by a factor of 10 or 20 or 50.
Yeah.
Don't worry, though, that wall isn't going to damage the spacecraft. I was asking about that recently. It's so tenuous.
Right. You're using words like heavy turbulence and wall.
Yeah.
What hazards are there, the primary hazards out there for such a spacecraft?
Well, I think we've really experienced the biggest hazards. Jupiter's radiation belt was a serious issue to get through it. There is always the possibility that we might hit some small particle. Our instrument can actually detect particles hitting the spacecraft. We get about maybe 4 or 5 impacts per year.
And these are small. These are not space rocks.
No, they're small, probably micron-sized particles. You know, a particle the size of a grain of sand at our great velocity would just go right through the spacecraft. It'll just make a hole right through it.
And that could mean the end of it.
It could.
A particle the size of a grain of sand.
Oh, yes.
So that tells you how empty space is.
We estimate there's about one of these particles every cubic kilometer. But these are micron size. They probably damage the outer skin of the spacecraft, but they're not big enough to make holes. And fortunately, we've not hit anything. We flew by the rings of Saturn, and we detected up to 500 impacts per second when we were going through the ring plane of Saturn. But these are all these small particles, and it probably sandblasted the surface. But we didn't get killed.
You've brought up so many times this hour the surprises, the discoveries that the Voyager projects have brought to light here. Let's spend a couple minutes talking about that ultimate question, which I would dare say you couldn't count how many times you've been asked about if there is life out there beyond our solar system, what this work has to do with it, what your decades of work tells you about the probability of life beyond our solar system.
Yeah, it's really a fascinating question. I'd say it's one of the most important scientific questions you can ask, you know, or even human questions. Is there life anyplace else in the solar system? Voyager, in the interstellar phase, I would say, does not have a strong role in that, but it certainly did when we flew by the planets, some of the moons of the planets. Like we discovered that the moon Europa at Jupiter has an ice surface but an ocean under it. And there are people that believe that life started at Earth at the bottom of the ocean in what are called geothermal vents. You perhaps have heard there are living things down there that don't rely on sunlight. They use sulfur that's coming out of these vents, and some people think that that's where life started on Earth. It's hard to say, but this moon, Europa, has an ocean, and it's got tidal heating, which keeps it warm enough that there's a liquid water ocean there. So you could very well have geothermal vents down there in the bottom in the ocean at Europa. And there's a long-term plan to actually land a submarine on the surface of Europa and go down there and see if we can find any living things. First, we have to measure the thickness of the ice, and I could do that. We built a radar for Mars Express, and if they'll just select us to fly that to Europa, I'll be glad to tell them whether the ice is 100 meters thick or 10 kilometers. If it's 10 kilometers, you're never going to get a submarine down there. So I do things that are
A submarine for another planet.
That's the plan. That's a discussion that we're having.
And it looks similar to a submarine here on Earth?
Well, probably not. We're probably going to use a radioactive heater to melt our way down through the ice and put a camera or some other instruments down there. Of course, you got to get the radio signal for telemetry signal back up to the surface somehow. A lot of complicated problems. I'm fascinated by this search for life thing. That's why we landed on Mars recently with Curiosity rover and to try to see if there might be life there.
We have about a minute left, but given the vastness of space, and you've given us an idea of it, if we didn't have it before, of just how vast space is, maybe the question is, could it not exist?
I think it's highly likely life exists someplace. Let me give you the argument there. You know, the number of stars in the solar system is about 10 to the 20th. That's a 10 with 20 zeros. Let me put that in a practical term. That's about equal to the number of grains of sand in all the beaches of Earth. Now, We didn't know whether a star typically has a planet or not, but there's some recent missions have been flown that tells us that planetary systems are very common. So you just have to have the right size planet where water can exist, and I'd say there's a good chance that life would form.
Okay.
That's my personal opinion.
The other question then, we don't have time for a comment. The other question is, would we ever be able to come in contact with it? Because we can't travel very fast, relatively speaking, right?
Well, there is the issue of looking for signals from other intelligent beings, and so far they've not found anything, but it would be a tremendous, you know, discovery if you really got a communication. But
Don Gurnett, what a pleasure to have you in our studio this entire hour. Voyager 1 scientist, University of Iowa space physicist. Thank you for joining us, Professor.
You're welcome.
And River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Emily Woodbury and Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Our theme music, written and performed by the River Monks. Once again, we'll mention that the link to Don Gurnett's lecture is on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page to find out more about Don Gurnett's work. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.